This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, forgiving each other. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the challenges of the family and forgiving each other. We can see in the life of the people that there are many disputes among the husband and wife. And even if there are two brothers, they do have dispute on different issues. But the main thing is we need to have the habit of forgiving each other, because in Islam, forgiving has a special reward. Generally, if we talk as a non-Islamic perspective, if someone forgives the other person, obviously it just brings the peace in their life, and that's it. There is nothing else, because they do not accept Islam, they do not believe in hereafter, they do not believe on the day of judgment. Therefore, the only thing for the people who are non-Muslims or who do not believe in hereafter, the only thing which comes in their life is the peace of mind, or the peace in the life, and a good bond or relationship between the husband and wife. And that's what the minimum of forgiving each other brings into a person's life. Therefore, even if we look at its worldly aspect, and if we want to have peace in our life, therefore we need to have this habit. And Islam emphasizes a lot on forgiving each other in the family relations, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of forgiving, and we said it is important that the husband and wife in their family relation do forgive each other. Now, I have a narration from the Prophet ﷺ in which he talked about the forgiving, like when a man forgives his wife, because of her etiquettes or because of her attitude. So it is important for the husband to forgive her wife, even if she's showing some immorality in her life. Therefore, we have a hadith or narration in which it is said, "Man sabara ala su'i khuluqi imra'atihi واحتسبه أعطاه الله بكل مرة يصبر عليها من الثواب مثل ما أعطى أيوب على بلائه." Now the translation is, whoever will have patience upon the immorality of his wife, Allah will, who have patience and he forgives her, Allah gives that person, that man, the reward which is just like the reward which was given to the Prophet Ayyub when he was patient on the griefs that he had, or the tests or trials that he had. And on the other hand, we have a similar hadith or narration about the woman. When a wife has a patience on the immorality of or misconduct of the husband, and it is said, "Man sabarat ala su'i khuluqi zawjiha a'taha mithla thawabi Asiyata binti Muzahim." And here the Prophet says that Allah gives whoever, a lady who does the, who have patience upon the immorality of her husband, Allah gives her reward which is similar to the reward which was given to Asiya, who was the wife of Pharaoh. We know that the Asiya was the wife of Pharaoh. So this is a two-way thing. And obviously in Islam, where it talks about the peace, on the other hand, it talks about the rewards in hereafter, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/Ian Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EN.
In the limelight.
Despite clampdown and protests that left dozens wounded, Palestinians say they remain undeterred in their fight to protect their land. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Hafifa Fayyad Ryder. This article is titled, Palestinian Bedouins Remain Resilient After a Week of Israeli Regime Crackdowns in Negev. Stay tuned for more. Within minutes of crowds arriving at a demonstration in the Negev desert on Thursday, January 13th, a volley of tear gas canisters, sound grenades, and skunk water fired by Israeli regime police began raining down on Palestinian protesters. Protesters told Middle East Eye, what was meant to be a large rally against the Zionist regime's latest land grab in the Negev quickly descended into mayhem. They want to deter us from protesting again, Rafat Awaisha, a Palestinian activist from Negev, told MEE. They want to displace us from our villages to plant housing projects elsewhere, Awaisha added. We want full recognition of our villages. We want recognition of our ownership before any other services. The protest was organized by the local council of Palestinians living in the Negev in response to the Zionist regime's bulldozers storming the villages of Al-Atrash Sawa earlier in the week. Palestinians from the Negev and the rest of the 48 Palestinian community, those who live within the borders of the occupied Palestinian territories, founded in 1948, amassed near the Al-Atrash Sawa intersection on Route 31 to denounce the resumption of tree planting work by the Jewish National Fund, JNF. Earlier this week, police guarded JNF tractors stormed the village of Al-Atrash Sawa for a third consecutive day to plant trees as part of a controversial forestation scheme. Negev residents say the program, which is carried out on land Palestinian Bedouins live on and use for cultivation, is the latest attempt of a decades-long government policy aimed at displacing them. They want to impose a new reality on the ground, Awaisha told MEE, adding, but people here don't want anyone taking their ownership of this land from them. The recent rally, which organizers say they had obtained permission from the police to organize, was violently dispersed by the Zionist regime's police before it could begin. A large number of the Zionist regime's special forces, mounted police, and a unit of elite undercover agents known as Mustabrin were positioned around the protest as chanting crowds began to arrive at 15 local time. Police had warned protesters via megaphone that they would disperse the protest within 10 minutes, but demonstrators told MEE that before children and the elderly could leave, police started firing sound bombs, rubber bullets, and tear gas. Awaisha told MEE, I was on the front lines. It took only 20 seconds after the announcement for them to fire the first sound bomb. He added, it was a frantic attack on everyone present. In the chaos that ensued, a man next to Awaisha was reportedly shot in the head with a rubber bullet. According to eyewitnesses, he was among dozens that were injured. Another protester, identified as Taleb al-Sawaida, 39, was critically wounded and remains in intensive care at Soroka Medical Center in the city of Be'er Sheva, known to Palestinians as Be'er al-Sabah. The Adala Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights, a Haifa-based advocacy group focusing on the rights of Palestinian citizens of the occupied territories, condemned the illegal means used during the police repression in a letter submitted to the Attorney General and the Inspector General of Police. The letter said, the law is clear. It is forbidden to use rubber bullets, rubber-coated steel bullets, grenades, and tear gas against defenseless demonstrators, and it is forbidden to shoot them from close range and targeting the upper part of the body. After the initial crackdown, the demonstrators were reportedly forced to retreat, and a cat-and-mouse game began with the police that lasted for at least 5 hours. Police also deployed skunk water and tear gas drones, protest dispersal methods rarely seen in the Negev. excessive violence was used, posing a threat to the lives of demonstrators, which constitutes a serious violation to individual and collective rights, Adala said in its letter. Despite the crackdown, protesters said the feeling that prevailed at the end of the day was a sense of growing resilience, pride, and hope that the plight of Palestinians in the Negev was getting some attention. Hend Salman, a local activist from the Negev, told MEE that what she witnessed was a glorious day. The protests were led by young men and women, some as young as 16 years old. A campaign to raise awareness about the plight of Bedouins in the Negev was trending on Palestinian social media under the hashtag #Save_Negev as protesters faced off with the police. Salman said there is a young generation breaking into the scene. They understand very well that they are up against and they have no fear. Some calm has been restored in Al-Atrash Sawa village after the JNF said on Wednesday, January 12th, that for now its tractors had ended their work in the village. But the troubles have now moved to the courts, as volunteer Palestinian lawyers scramble to defend the detained protesters. Since Monday, January 10th, at least 130 Palestinians have been arrested, including several minors. The majority are still detained. The high volume of arrests, which have continued into Friday, January 14th, has overwhelmed the 10 Palestinian lawyers from the Negev, who volunteered to represent the protesters as an act of solidarity with the families. Backup help came from 5 Palestinian lawyers from northern areas of the country, which was appreciated by the Negev residents, according to Awaisha, who was present in court. In and out of the courtrooms, lawyers spent their full days attending to cases and arguing for clients from as early as 7 a.m. and until as late as 1 a.m. local time. The toll of the arrest and the violence seen has been heavy, Awaisha said, but it has not broken the spirit of the protesters. Awaisha said families are understandably worried about their children. They are in a war against land theft, but people remain steadfast.
Start. Movement. Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station.
Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamite.
Islamite.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all of time.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the merciful. This is Youth Station, and I'm glad to be here. Well, we have my friend.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa salaamu alaikum.
I'm Zainab, Sister Asma's co-host, and I'm totally happy to be with you guys today.
And today we are going to talk about the pros and cons of being silent.
Okay, pros and cons of being silent. If you're on a radio show, all cons. Don't be silent, because that's totally defeats the objective of being on a radio show or in a podcast or something, or if you're at an interview, please talk.
So are you a silent person?
I'm an introvert.
Yes.
I'm an introvert, so sometimes I feel it depends on the circumstance.
Exactly. It depends.
Right.
On the people around me and the society I'm in.
And the topic of the discussion.
If I have no interest in it, yes.
I'm not going to bother inserting any opinion.
I'm not going to open a box of worms. That's better.
Yes. Let's not do that. Let's not get into that at all.
Let's be away with the problems.
If I'm among friends.
Yes.
Like my own.
I'm totally extrovert.
Yeah. Bubbly, chirpy, talking.
Wearing no masks.
Exactly. Making jokes and jests and talking about everything and anything.
Yes.
And goofing around.
Exactly.
And like if you're really in your comfort zone.
That's why being with friends means wearing no masks.
Yes. And that's why it's so wonderful.
Still, I don't know if I'm extrovert or introvert.
You're definitely an introvert.
Based on what I have with my friends.
No, you're definitely an introvert. Introverts are those that only vibe with their people.
Yes.
Extroverts are those that vibe with people.
Everyone.
Just if you're a person, yes. I'm a vibe with you.
Yes.
More power to them. I'm proud of extroverts for being able to do that.
Sometimes I envy them. They can speak everything softly. Very easy.
Yeah, open the conversation with everyone and anyone. But being around an extrovert makes me really anxious.
Yes.
And I find during those situations, silence is the best treat. Not that that person talks to me and I totally ignore them, look at the air. But like, I don't necessarily try to push myself. Before, when I was younger, I would try to push myself to engage in whatever small talk the extrovert is trying to initiate. I would always find myself saying the wrong things because I can't function in that sort of setting.
Yes, exactly.
I'd find myself regretting what I said later on. I'd find myself talking about things that sort of weren't in the limitations of my boundaries.
And every time worried about not saying things in the right time.
Yes. And I'd stay up at night overthinking it.
Yes, exactly.
Why did I say that? Yes. Should I have said that? Should I have said something else? Do they think I'm weird
now? I shouldn't have said that.
Yes. That's the worst feeling in the world.
Yes, that
is. And if you practice silence long enough, you won't have that problem anymore.
Yes.
Just keep quiet, man.
It's me. I don't speak.
Exactly. As I got older, I felt that, look, I don't necessarily have to please everyone.
Exactly. Right? That's the point. As we grow older, we understand this fact that we're not here to please everyone.
No, because we're not a jar of Nutella, darling. When I realized that it's not my job to please everyone.
Yes.
And that I am allowed to set boundaries. And if I feel like this conversation, it's not necessarily violating anything. Right?
Exactly. You're not breaking any rule.
Yeah. And they're not violating anything either. But this is just not my style. I can't talk to you like this. So I just keep silent. I nod and smile.
Mm-hmm. All breathing beings are different from each other. It's like the fingerprints. No one is like the other one. We're all different, so we have to embrace that.
Exactly.
Yes, but have you ever been sorry for not speaking?
No. I've found that that's always...
Because I'm a silent person. Sometimes I eat myself a lot.
Why
you didn't speak at the moment?
What would you have gained had you spoken?
Speaking of my rights.
Uh-huh. Of your rights, then yes.
Yes.
Well, actually, no. I mean, I know that there are a lot of ahadith telling us to claim our rights, stand up for what's right, stand up for justice. If it's someone else's right and I was quiet about it, I might feel a little guilty.
Yes.
But if it was my own right, I always justified by saying, you know what, I can't be bothered with drama. Who cares? You know, just go. Just get out of my face. I don't even want my right anymore. You know what I mean?
Have I told you? Yes. I'm like that. I say to myself that, okay, I don't wish to open a box of worms. Mm. I don't wish to face those difficulties.
And conflict.
It's better to
be confrontation.
Silent. Yes, exactly. It's better to stay silent rather than starting a long discussion that's going to be a never-ending discussion.
Definitely.
So that's why I bringing keep about drama. Of time. Yes,
drama. I can't stand drama.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, like in expressing myself, I can be over dramatic and I can be like all over the place when I'm
because
talking.
Because even if I open up my chapters, that will going to be a long novel.
Mm.
A lot of stories would come out of it.
Exactly.
So it's better to stay silent.
Yeah, just keep to yourself. People don't need to know. The confrontation thing is what really...
I can't the hurting part is the confrontation.
Yeah,
part.
I can't do it. I just can't. Let's talk about moments where most probably you should not stay silent.
Yes.
Aside from interviews. Yeah. And when you're like with a child.
Yes, when you're with a child.
Don't be quiet around the poor child.
No, they won't let you be silent.
True.
They would bring you into speaking.
Yes, They would ask so many questions.
Yes, of
that,
course.
Like, at some point, you'd be like, you know what? Fine.
Questions that are good for introverts.
Yes, fine. Let's talk about that three-eyed worm that you saw in the cartoon the other day.
Yes, exactly.
I think we've already mentioned standing up for someone's rights, our own rights, for justice.
Yes, justice.
I think there's a hadith that tells us that if we are silent in the face of oppression, we have a share of that bun, that oppression that's been carried out.
We have a share.
Because it's sort of like, I didn't support that person, but I didn't stop them either.
Yes, true.
And it's sort of like allowing them.
And it happens every day. It's not something like it should happen like a revolution. No, in everyday life, we face it. Mm-hmm. Many times we cannot face the people who are tyrants in a small zones, in a smaller scopes.
Yeah, yeah.
And we cannot stand for our rights, but we have to.
That's why maybe the concept of Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy anil Munkar, enjoining the bad and forbidding the evil, is so important in Islam.
Yes.
And I feel like, you know, standing up for justice, like when you said everyday life.
Yes.
I thought about people who litter, people who throw their trash on the street, out of the car window. That's injustice.
Yes, injustice.
And if you just honk your horn and just give them like the dirty death glare.
Yes.
Dude, what are you doing? Or like, look at them, and then look at the trash can, and then look at them really
but
intensely.
But they did not notice that, really.
But they will feel a little shameful.
Yes, maybe a little shame.
And if the society constantly does that to someone who still has the barbaric habit
the
of
nice
littering,
word to use for them.
Right? After a while, they'll pull themselves together. And the same goes to Amr bil Ma'ruf wa Nahy
anil Munkar. Yes, that needs everyone to react against them, not only one person.
Definitely.
We need to be all the same.
Mm-hmm.
We have to react.
We need to be united.
Yes, we need to be united, exactly.
United on on an ideology, on a certain value.
Yes.
No one is going to argue with the fact that littering is bad.
Exactly.
Even that savage who feels like, well, the cleaning person will just come pick it up. And then you explain it to them. That just because it's their job doesn't mean that you shouldn't be doing your job.
Exactly. That's the most awful way of thinking, to say that because it's someone else's job, then I don't have to care. We are all responsible. Okay, everyone who's been listening to us, stay tuned. We're going to have a break and then we'll catch up together. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
Listeners of Youth Station, we're back and we're going to follow the discussion. We are all having some duties in this society for the environment, for the people around us, for the future upbringing.
Yes. And it's these little things that build up to it. Like, these little acts of being indifferent toward oppression and being silent toward them that leads to something like, I don't know,
a greater loss.
Yes, to genocides and massacres.
Exactly.
And full-blown wars.
I think responsibility in everything does matter.
Totally. Yes, yes. Feeling a sense of responsibility. And I was reading this really interesting quote in a book. It said Something may not be your fault,
yeah,
but it's still your responsibility. And the example, author was mentioning was that you wake up one morning and you find an infant on your doorstep.
Yes.
Right? Someone just left him there in the middle of the night. And you open the door to go grab the newspaper, and then you see this little basket, and there's this helpless little infant baby inside of it.
Yes.
Are you just going to leave the baby there on the doorframe?
Of course not.
It wasn't your fault that the baby was there, but now it is your responsibility.
From now on, you have to take it.
Yes, to react, to do whatever. Yes. Take it to the police station. Take it to the orphanage.
Yes,
make some
whatever.
Phone calls, whatever.
Just help that child.
No one's going to blame you for the child baby's existence. But now, if the baby dies because you didn't do anything about it, you're going to jail.
Yeah.
Another instance where silence is good. There are so many ahadith about this. When there's an argument... And I feel that...
No, they say leave the situation.
Yeah, just because... Or like there's a hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam. He says, when you're arguing with a fool, just
leave
quiet.
Them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, when there's a jadal, there's an argument, there's a debate. Not that debate of like when Imam al-Ridha alayhi salam debated with the Christian priests about Islam. Not that scale of debate. But when someone's just arguing
when
with you...
When you do not have any hope for that person to understand what you say.
Just be quiet, even if you were right.
Yes. Most of the time, you are right, but you'd better stay silent. Because they would drag you down to their level.
Exactly.
And they won't understand what you're saying.
And you're just going to end up with mud all over yourself.
Yes.
That person doesn't care.
You'd be mocking yourself.
Yes, bringing down your own value.
Yes, exactly.
Just stay quiet, fam. It doesn't matter. You know you're right. An intelligent person who's present knows you're right.
Yes, exactly.
That's enough.
Those who know.
And that's all that matters. And trying to prove yourself to that person who's arguing with you. Look, if they were intelligent enough, they wouldn't argue to begin with.
Exactly.
Right?
They wouldn't have started it at the first point.
Exactly. They would have pointed out their opinion, you would have pointed out your opinion, end of discussion.
Yes.
Right? You would have agreed to disagree. But the fact that they're arguing means they're not worth the time to argue with.
Yes. And another instance for when it is not right to speak is about rumors. When you hear a rumor, it's better to cut that line.
Yeah,
you be the one who finishes the story.
Mm-hmm. Break
That's
that chain.
Better to stay silent.
Exactly.
Because speaking is not going to change anything.
No.
And you're going to be helping the people who have some evil thoughts, perhaps. So you have to stay silent there, too.
Definitely.
That's going to be better for you and the one who's been rumored. Well, that's it. We talked about silence, when it is good and when it's not good, the pros and the cons, and we understood that sometimes it's better to stay silent and know sometimes you have to speak of your own rights and of the oppressed people's right for justice, for the sake of justice. So thank you for listening to us. This was Asma and Zainab. We talked about silence. This is IRIB English Radio. Thank you for listening to us.
I am what I am because you made. I have what I have. My love is strong. Because of you, in weakness I am braver. My defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance. I will when I need you, the light when I seek you. Justice, forgiveness, the strength in my weakness, and my love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my alpha and omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you.
in the limelight.
Many of Blair's enemies believe that he lied, says Chris Mullen, writer, in an article published under the heading, Tony Blair can never escape his role in the Iraq disaster. Stay tuned for more. Blair, the former British Prime Minister, who more than anyone else was responsible for persuading the British Parliament and a majority of the public that British troops should take part in the invasion of Iraq, remains in denial. Almost alone, he insists to this day that it was the right decision, but one has only to look into his eyes whenever he is challenged on the subject to see that he is haunted by it. Iraq never goes away. 20 years on, the subject is back in the headlines following a decision by the Queen to make Blair a Knight of the Garter, one of the UK's highest honors awarded solely at the discretion of the monarch. Ordinarily, such an award to a former prime minister, particularly one who held office for a decade, would be uncontroversial. Sooner or later, most former prime ministers are also so honored, and no one raises an eyebrow. This time, however, it is different. No sooner had the announcement been made than Blair's many enemies launched an online petition requesting that the Queen reconsider. Overwhelmingly, the signatories are likely to be those who opposed the war from the outset, many of whom regard Blair as the devil incarnate. But the right-wing media, who at the time were by and large in favor of the war, are also stirring the pot. In particular, they have alighted upon a recent memoir by Blair's former defense secretary, Geoff Hoon, who alleges that he was ordered by an official in Blair's office to burn a memorandum from the Attorney General, which implied that without a specific UN endorsement, the war was illegal. The official concerned, who incidentally is the very one quoted by film producer Friend, denies ever having given such an order. All the same, Hoon's allegation has a plausible ring to it. Everyone knows that the former Attorney General Peter Goldsmith struggled to find a legal justification for the war. The bigger picture is this. From the moment Bush became president, Iraq was always going to be invaded. The only decision for the UK, the closest ally to the US, was whether or not we would participate. And even had they chosen not to, British troops would have ended up in Iraq anyway, because after the invasion, they, like other major powers, would have felt obliged to go in and, with the backing of the UN, help clear up. It is also true, however, that like France and Germany, the UK could have opted out of the war. Bush gave Blair that option when it became apparent that Blair's own position was threatened. As Bush remarked at the time, he was seeking a regime change in Baghdad, not London. Blair was anxious to get involved partly because, like all British prime ministers, he believed that it was in Britain's strategic interest to keep in line with the Americans. Also, one suspects it was because it gave him a role on the global stage that he would not otherwise have had, though at times it looked a little humiliating. One U.S. newspaper dubbed him America's newest ambassador. In fairness, and contrary to what is sometimes asserted, Blair was not without influence in Washington. It was he who, together with the then U.S. Secretary of State, Colin Powell, persuaded Bush to overrule then Vice President Dick Cheney and take the issue to the U.N. Security Council in hopes of a resolution explicitly authorizing an invasion in the event of Saddam Hussein's non-cooperation with weapons inspectors. For Bush and the small coterie of his father's friends who surrounded him, however, Iraq was unfinished business. Cheney and then Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld were veterans of George Bush Sr.'s administrations. They regretted not overthrowing Saddam's regime when they had the chance following Saddam's eviction from Kuwait in 1991. They were the key decision makers in Washington and they were not going to be deflected. In his memoir, Against All Enemies, a former U.S. National Security Advisor, Richard A. Clark, describes the difficulty he and his colleagues had in persuading Bush to take seriously the threat posed by Al-Qaeda. He then describes what happened when he went into the White House the day after 9/11. Clark writes, "I expected to go back to a round of meetings examining what the next attacks could be, what our vulnerabilities were, what we could do about them in the short time. Instead, I walked into a series of discussions about Iraq. At first, I was incredulous that we were talking about something other than getting Al-Qaeda. Then I realized with almost a sharp physical pain that Rumsfeld and his deputy Paul Wolfowitz were going to try to take advantage of this national tragedy to promote their agenda about Iraq," unquote. Later that day, he and some colleagues came across Bush alone in the Situation Room. "He grabbed a few of us and closed the door. Look," he told us, "I know you have a lot to do and all, but I want you as soon as you can to go back over everything. See if Saddam did this. See if he's linked in any way." I was once again taken aback. "But, Mr. President, Al-Qaeda did this," according to Clark's account. Bush replied, I know, but see if Saddam was involved. Just look." There was, of course, no evidence that Saddam had anything to do with 9/11, and there was no evidence that he possessed chemical weapons. Many of Blair's enemies believe that he lied. The consequences of the Iraq War are well known. Even by the terms of reference of those who planned the war, it was surely a catastrophe. Al-Qaeda, which wasn't present before the invasion, became rampant in personal terms, although this pales into comparison to the wider consequences. It is a tragedy.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable Discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin, January 5th, 2022.
Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master, Muhammad, and his pure household, particularly the remnant of God on earth.
رحمت خدا رضوان خدا بر شهید عزیزمون که ماجرای شهادت این عزیز بزرگوار یک حادثه ملی بلکه یک حادثه بین الملل اسلامی شد و خب دومین سالگرد هست مردم دارن این کارها رو میکنن.
May God's mercy and paradise be bestowed upon our dear martyr whose martyrdom turned into a national and international matter in the world of Islam. Well, this is the second anniversary for him, and people are doing many things in commemorating him. Later on, I will expand on the things people are doing. In fact, we are only following what the people are doing. Our meeting and our statements are actually a continuation of the innovative moves being made by the people throughout the country. I previously spoke of the Soleimani School of Thought. Shahid Soleimani turned into a school of thought, or it was so from the beginning. Praise God, I have seen that many books have been published about this school of thought, books that I hadn't seen before. If we want to briefly explain what we call the Soleimani school of thought, we should say that it is summarized in truthfulness and sincerity.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
این دو کلمه در واقع عنوان و نماد و نمایه مکتب سلیمانی است. صدق یعنی همون چیزی که در آیه شریفه من المؤمنین رجال صدقوا ما عهد الله علیه که حالا مختصری توضیح عرض میکنه.
These two words are actually the title, symbol and emblems of Martyr Soleimani's school of thought. Truthfulness is what we can see in the holy verse of the Holy Quran. Of the believers are men who are true to the covenant which they made with Allah. The Holy Quran, Surah 33, verse 23. I will expand on this later. Sincerity, too, has been mentioned in numerous verses in the Quran, including, Say, verily I command that I should serve Allah, being sincere to Him in obedience. The Holy Quran, Surah 39, verse 11. These two verses from the Quran formed the basis of Martyr Soleimani's movement.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
At a press conference in Moscow, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov touched not only on negotiations with the West, but also the peacekeeping operation in Kazakhstan and the upcoming meeting of the presidents of Iran and Russia.
The visit, in short, is very important. It's time to resume contacts at the highest level, which are traditionally close and regular among us, and which also fell victim to the coronavirus infection. The significance of the visit, first of all, is the need to take an inventory of our entire agenda, taking into account considering the new government in Iran.
Lavrov added that Moscow is in favor of holding a conference on security in the Persian Gulf, where it would be possible to discuss the claims accumulated both by Iran against its Arab neighbors and by its Arab neighbors against the Islamic Republic.
Such forum can unite Iranians and Arabs. Each of the parties would put their concerns on the table. They would also talk about their concerns over Yemen, Syria, Iraq, and other volatile areas that somehow cause controversy between other countries.
Regarding relations with the West, Russia has come up with offers of security guarantees as its patience has run out. Moscow is waiting for the West to give a concrete and written answer to its initiative and is not going to wait indefinitely. Last month, Russia's foreign ministry published draft security proposals between Moscow and Washington on ensuring the security of Russia and NATO member states. Consultations on these issues were held on January 10th in Geneva, a session of the NATO-Russia Council was held on January 12th in Brussels, and a meeting of the OSCE Permanent Council took place on January 13th in Vienna.
The appearance of NATO on the Russian borders is categorically unacceptable. This is a real red line. The appearance of U.S. weapons and military bases there on the Sea of Azov is the second red line. It simply reflects the West's overreach, to put it bluntly, in violation of all obligations, in violation of common sense.
Lavrov said NATO had come ever closer to Russia's borders during five waves of expansion starting 1997, when it formalized its relations with NATO. The diplomat said it absolutely cannot suit Russia when it is required to send troops to barracks on its territory, while at the same time the Americans, the Canadians and the British are building bases in Ukraine and the Black Sea region.
Russia's efforts to strengthen ties with its neighbors demonstrate differences between the CSTO and NATO. Russia and its allies leave countries at the end of military missions, thus establishing strategic partnerships. And regarding unfriendly policies adopted by Western governments towards Russia, Moscow advocates for constructive dialogue and mutual respect. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
India's Supreme Court has notified the northern state of Uttarakhand and New Delhi authorities to investigate the recent incidents of vicious hate speeches by several Hindu religious leaders, which called for Muslim genocide. The petitioner stated such incidents, if not addressed with the rule of law, pose a grave threat not just to the unity and integrity of the country, but also endanger the lives of millions of Muslim citizens. Activists call it encouraging move.
The Muslims of this country, when they decided to stay back and not migrate to Pakistan, the reason was that they believed in a system which is not based on any religion, which a constitution, an idea of India which is plural, which is diverse, which respects each and every citizen equally.
Since the partition of the subcontinent in 1947, Indian Muslims have been subjected to widespread discrimination, but it all swelled after the emergence of BJP in 2014. The community has been subjected to deliberate vicious hate campaigns and violence. Several Muslim organizations accuse the government of Prime Minister Modi of turning blind eye towards the issue.
Last few years have been overly violent, considering the growing hostility towards the community. Experts say this could tear apart social harmony in a diversified country which has a long-standing history of terrific communal violence.
Anti-Muslim sentiments have risen extensively. Since last few years, Hindu mobs have unleashed striking attacks on Muslims, lynched dozens of people, mainly Muslims and Dalits, accusing them of indistinct activities in addition to other systematic repression. Activists call it the pretext of a larger political agenda to turn India into a supremacist Hindu nation.
This is part of the larger design. It is not that they are doing it on their own. They know that they have state patronage. They have patronage from the political party, the BJP and the RSS. And so they are emboldened.
As India's state elections draw near, anti-Muslim rhetoric is flaring across the country, which experts call a political gimmick to polarize the community, therefore playing a divide-and-rule policy. Activists, however, maintain that resistance to the violent and divisive politics is also growing. Munawar Zaman, New Delhi.
This is the first time Hossein Amir Abdullahian visited China as Iran's foreign minister. The one-day trip came upon an invitation by his Chinese counterpart, Wang Yi. The visit marked the beginning of the implementation of the much-anticipated Sino-Iranian pact known as the 25-year strategic partnership.
In this trip, we agreed to start implementing the 25-year comprehensive strategic cooperation agreement. I also delivered a written message from our president to his Chinese counterpart, Mr. Xi, to implement the agreement.
The Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership was announced in a joint statement during a visit by Chinese President Xi Jinping to Iran in 2016. In 2020, Wang Yi and then Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif signed the pact in Tehran. So far, no detailed information has been revealed from the agreement, but the two sides say it covers economic, political, and security areas.
During today's meeting, we talked about industrial, scientific, technological, and economic areas, as well as tourism and other subjects that are covered by the 25-year agreement.
During the talks, China also reiterated its support for Iran's nuclear rights in the ongoing Vienna talks aimed at removing U.S. sanctions, which Washington reinstated against Iran in 2018 after it unilaterally left the 2015 deal. As signatories to the accord, China and Russia both urge Washington to remove the sanctions as the only path to rejoin the deal.
Today, we extensively discussed the Vienna talks over the removal of U.S. sanctions on Iran. China's representative in Vienna, along with his Russian counterpart, plays a positive part in advocating Iran's nuclear rights and the removal of the anti-Iran sanctions.
China is Iran's number one trade partner. This partnership heavily relies on Iran's oil supply to energy-hungry China. Reports show that in 2021, and despite U.S. oil embargoes on Iran, China tripled its oil imports from Iran. Now the implementation of the new pact will guarantee the flow of Iran's oil to China and cement the two sides' trade ties. It goes without saying that China and Iran are strategic partners in every sense. And the top Iranian diplomat's trip is a sign that Tehran is determined to keep that path with Beijing. The two sides are expected to engage even more as the 25-year strategic partnership has moved from paper to practice. Yusuf Jalali from the Chinese city of Fuzhou.
If you want to keep warm this winter and can't afford to keep your heating on, wear an extra layer, do star jumps, or hug your pet for warmth, if you have one, that is. 3 of 10 recommendations from Britain's third largest energy supplier,